tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO is excited to be part of the Willamette Week Give Guide this year. When you support KBOO through Give Guide, not only does it support your favorite community radio station, it also gives you a little back in return. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get full access to hundreds of local coupons in the Chinook Book app, plus a few other goodies. Available while supplies last. So donate to KBOO on Give Guide today at kboo.fm/give. And thanks.
There's so much that we need to share, so send a smile and show you care.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello, this is Lane Ponce, your host this evening at KBOO, and the Labor Radio Show is on the air now. We have a couple guests with us today. One guest is my co-host, Susan Stoner. The other guest is movie maker and book writer, Mr. Kelly Baker. So good evening, both of you. How are you doing, Kelly?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being here. And Susan.
Thank you also for allowing me to co-host with you. And it's wonderful to see you both on Zoom.
Yeah, Zooming away. And Susan, why don't you start with the lead question for Kelly?
Well, Kelly, I bought your filmmaker books, not because I'm a videographer but mostly because my husband is one, and so it was gifts. But you know, every time I picked it up and started reading it, I could not put it down. And the latest one is called The Angry Filmmaker Survival Guide. And it was so darn interesting about the industry, and you are such a great writer. And I have seen, I have read both of your non-filmmaking guides. One is called Road Dog, and another one is Arawana Tumulshu, which is a collection of sort of short stories we shared between you and another author. So totally love those. But since this is a labor show, I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit about what it's like to be a worker in the film industry, and then a little bit about what it's like to be a filmmaker director, because I have seen your movies and they're fabulous. And I want to really, you did one coming of age book called Kicking Bird. A movie called Kicking Bird, which is just incredibly good. It's one of the best I've ever seen. So with that, what's it like to be a worker?
Boy, how can I top this introduction? First, I want to say that the short story collection is called From Arowana to Muleshoe, Misfit Stories from Misspent Lives. And Arowana is a church camp up on Mount Hood. Anyway, what's it like being a worker bee? It's one of those things where I've been doing this for 40 plus years, and I have my own company for my films, but when I work on other people's films, it all comes to my company. And you know, for me, it's been great. It's unsteady as all get out. You know, I don't have a regular job. I don't have regular clients. I don't have regular hours, no vacation time, no medical insurance. I do now, thanks to President Obama. But so it's kind of, I guess it's gig work at its best, part of the gig economy. And I knew that one going in. And so, you know, I'm not a fan of the gig economy when it comes to things like Lyft and people who have to, you know, depend on it for their living. In the film business, that's all we do. And in my mind, it's a different thing. But, you know, one of the things about what I do is we don't get to call our own shots when it comes to hours. We have deadlines. And so I have not worked on a set for years when they're shooting something, but I know that those people work anywhere from 12 to 16 hour days. And that's the way it is. I do a lot of post-production sound design work, so I'm in the editing room or on the sound mixing stage. And we will do 12, 14 hours when we need to. We try to keep everything to 10 hours a day. And that is industry standard for, you know, the film business. Like I said, I know an awful lot of people who work a lot more hours than that, but trying to get overtime usually doesn't happen, you know. So, but we have deadlines and we just have to make those deadlines.
Well, I too read one of your books, The Road Dog, and it was very entertaining and I enjoyed it immensely. And you also talked about traveling all over. So it looked like you kind of had teaching gigs, film festivals, and then you sell a lot of stuff along the way too. But some of your travel adventures were very entertaining. Which one was maybe your favorite or one of your favorites?
Boy, my favorite. You know, I did the touring, is what I call it, because I was showing my films and promoting my books all over the country. And I'd go out for 2 months at a time with my dog at the time, Moses. And, you know, I don't know about favorite times. I mean, I went to a lot of film festivals, and those were always great. It's always great to see good friends. I love places like Kansas City and Tulsa, where, you know, Oklahoma, where I've got good friends. You know, the only time I think I ever wrote about anything really, really bad was the weather when you're trying to make it to a gig. But I loved being on the road. During the pandemic, of course, I really missed that part of it. I can say one night in Waco, Texas, I ended up, I was staying at a hotel down there, me and the dog, and they had a fire pit out in the parking lot, which was right off the freeway. So you can see what a wonderful, you know, spot it was in Waco, Texas. But I met a fellow there who was a third generation demolition man from Texas. And he was there, they were taking down a big water tower, and he was the guy who was imploding it. And so, talk about a great night to talk to somebody whose business is blowing stuff up. Does it get any better than that? You know,
every boy man's drink, right?
And drinking wine in a parking lot at a hotel in Waco. So, you know, I mean, I've had a lot of fun and I've got to meet some amazing people. And I built up a following for both my films and my books that way.
One of the stories that I was enchanted by had to do with the darkened windows on your van and trying to get in and out of states where it's illegal. Let's hear about that little adventure.
There's only one state. There's a chapter in the book about every time I go through Iowa. And I have good friends in Iowa, and I like my friends in Iowa, but the state police are always looking for an excuse to pull me over. And for about 4 years running on the same spot on the freeway early in the morning, I'd be, you know, on the interstate, and there would be a state cop sitting, you know, around this corner, and I'd come through, and I was never, you know, going over the speed limit or anything, because I'm good about that. I've got out-of-state plates in 49 states, so I'm going to be careful when I drive. But it was four different officers, and, you know, I'd drive past them, and immediately they're behind me, waiting for me to make a mistake, which I don't do, but they turn on their lights anyway. And their excuse is that my windows are tinted too dark. But what they really want to do, they want to pull me over probably because I look suspicious, or they think I'm Jerry Garcia, one of the two, you know, and make sure that there's nothing illicit. They never even search the van. Once I give them my ID, all this other stuff, they write me out these warnings. And I started giving, you know, when they say ask for my insurance card and everything else, I would hand them the warnings that I've been getting the previous year, and they would just kind of look at me like, we don't need that. And I was like, yeah, I know, but, you know, I just want to let you guys know that this is becoming a series here. And yeah, Iowa is the one state that they always pull me over.
And it's because of the darkened windows on your van.
Right, and my windows are absolutely legal for the state of Oregon, which is where I live, and where the van is registered. So you know it's just a ploy to pull me over. Because I get passed by, on the freeways there in Iowa, I'll get passed by cars that their windows are much darker than mine and they have Iowa plates.
Wow. So Susan, ask him some more questions.
You do look a bit like a slender Jerry Garcia.
Thank you. We joke about that. I met him a few times before he passed away, and I don't think I look like him at all. And I don't think he would say he looks like me either. But there's, I don't know, there's something about that 60s look, whatever it is.
Well, and being in Iowa, I mean, that's
too, right? I wonder if Jerry ever went to Iowa.
Yeah, a couple times with darkened windows. Well, I know that one of the movies that you made is called The Gas Cafe, and I really enjoyed that, but I was never really sure who is alive and who is dead. What was your inspiration behind that movie?
Oh, boy. You know, I imagine the gas cafe, you know, when I travel a lot, I always say that, you know, I might be in the United States or in Europe or whatever, but truly I'm someplace between heaven and hell. And the gas cafe to me takes place in that space. And so is it real? Are the characters alive? Are they dead? Who's to say? But they're still interacting. Some of them, if they are dead, they have no clue. They don't realize it.
It was very entertaining. And the atmosphere was a cafe on the road atmosphere. It was very nice. Very nice. Susan, which one was your favorite movie?
Kicking Bird. I thought that it was just a real jewel. I can't say enough positive about it. I'm not very fond of coming of age kinds of movies, but that one was incredibly good, and the lead actor was fabulous. So I just thought that was super. I did have a question. What is it like to, or what is the industry like in Oregon? What kind of support do you get from the state? If you're an actor, is it, you know, a good place to be if you want to do film?
Boy, I don't know if I'm the right person to answer that, especially from an actor standpoint, because I have never received anything from the state. I've never asked either. I love living up here. I'm native here. I lived in LA for 5 years going to school and learning my craft, but I came back home because I believed in independent filmmaking. And there were a lot of us at the time, and this is the early to mid 80s, who were here doing, you know, kind of doing the same thing. And I like to say we all grew up together. I know there's a really vibrant industry here. Most of my work when I'm doing sound design work actually comes from other states. I rarely work on Portland projects. And it's not that I don't wish to. I think I've spent so much time away from here for so long. And for my entire career, most of the big work that I've done for hire has been either from LA or New York, or now I'm finishing up a film for a friend of mine in Kentucky. The last film I did was a film out of Houston. And so truly I may be here, located here, but work for me comes in everywhere. I choose to make my films here because this is my home. And I like to work with the locals here. I've got a lot of great friends in the business. But like I say, as far as getting things from the state, I don't, and I've never really asked. Usually when you want participation from others, there's always strings attached. And I guess I like to say, I'm, you know, although all the Jerry Garcia references aside, I'm kind of an old punk. I'm a DIY guy, and it's all about doing it myself. And if I can figure out how to do it and get it done, then I retain control. I retain copyrights on all of my work. And that's the way I prefer it. So, like I said, I know we have a vibrant film industry up here, and there are a lot of people who are doing great things.
Why don't you tell us about some of your formal education down in California and some of the works that you're known for that get you called back?
I went to University of Southern California, their film school, and I went there back in the 70s. I joke that I got in just before the first Star Wars came out, the original Star Wars came out, and USC at the time would get 500 applicants for 40 slots. And I was lucky I got in because after Star Wars came out, I had heard that they were getting 5,000 applicants for those same 40 slots. So if I, you know, if I'd been younger, I might not have been able to get in. But the program was amazing because we made a lot of films. We worked on a lot of stuff. It was very much hands-on, but there was a lot of theory and history that, you know, to round out our education. And so that was really good. When I came back up to Portland, because I decided I wanted to be in the independent world, one of my first jobs was with Will Vinton, the clay animator, and I was the co-editor and did most of the sound work on The Adventures of Mark Twain. And I've done a couple of claymation projects with him over the years, Meet the Raisins, the Claymation Christmas Carol, some other stuff. But I also became friends with Gus Van Sant. And so I was the sound designer on My Own Private Idaho, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, Good Will Hunting, To Die For. I worked with Todd Haynes on Far From Heaven. I've done all sorts of stuff. Those are probably the most famous films of other people's that I've worked on. But I've done all sorts of other television, and I've done a lot of uncredited work too.
Uncredited, yeah.
Which is fine as long as the checks don't bounce.
Yeah. Right. Susan, do you have some more questions for him?
Well, we've heard a lot about how the film industry has been going up to Vancouver, BC to do filming. What's behind that, and what's that mean for U.S. workers?
Well, anytime a film is shooting out of the country, you know, it's a loss for U.S. workers, obviously. A lot of it has to do with the currency exchange and the kind of deals that other countries will give. For the longest time, it's been a lot cheaper to work up in Canada. So, I mean, that was a primary reason behind Canada. And they have great crews and people up there, too. There have been deals in Europe. I know a film that a friend of mine did. They got this amazing deal to shoot in England, in Great Britain. And with all the tax breaks and everything else that was offered, I mean, they saved millions of dollars by shooting over there because of tax incentives. Oregon gives out tax incentives now for independent or for films and TV series that choose to shoot up here. Most of the states do. I think the biggest impact anymore with runaway productions, as we call them, has been on California. Because although all the companies are headquartered there, they all want to try to save a buck. And so, you know, you can shoot cheaper in North Carolina, or you go to Louisiana, or you can go to, so all the other states are realizing that here's a business that really doesn't pollute. You know, I mean, it's, it hires a lot of people, and it's not just the people that are working on the film, because they need to be housed, they need to be fed, you know, there's transportation. So, I always like to see more tax incentives happening, especially in a place like Oregon, because for every dollar that's actually, you know, they give away in tax incentives, there's a lot more money that's coming in, you know, for that, because of all the peripheral businesses that are associated with it, i.e. the caterers, you know, hotels, transport, all that other stuff. So I always think that this is a pretty green business overall, if you will, because, you know, we're not doing horrible things to the environment, although the occasional explosion maybe, but, you know, it's for the most part, I think it's a good business to be involved with from that aspect.
Well, I notice you have a website, of course, with a lot of your books and your videos and movies.
Yes.
And it is called angryfilmmaker.com.
Right.
Angry filmmaker. Is that you? Are you an angry filmmaker? And if so, why?
Absolutely. I am the angry filmmaker. I was named that years and years ago by a whole bunch of other filmmakers because they would look at my work. And, you know, and we talk about changes we want to see happen. And they just started referring to me as the angry filmmaker. And after a while, I thought, you know, I just need to embrace this. And so I've embraced the name. And the nice part about that is I can rail against a lot of things that I feel strongly about. And people will say, you know, that's just him, that's the angry filmmaker. And now it's kind of expected. And so there are certain things, especially when it comes to film distribution, that I'm very angry about. I mean, the fact that people are always asking me why my films aren't on Netflix. Well, if Netflix wants one of my films, the contract I have to sign with them basically gives them the rights and they can recut it if they wish. Are you kidding me? You know, this is my film. You can't re, you know. And so, like I said, whenever you make deals, there's always trade-offs. And I just don't do that. It gets back to the whole punk thing again. You know, I create this stuff. I do everything I can to make it happen and bring in the right people. And so why am I going to give away the rights to things?
I think the book industry is the same thing. As an author, you find that, for example, one of the big distribution houses, if you want to distribute through them as an independent writer and not attached to a big, huge publishing corporation, probably owned by somebody in Germany, who they also take all the rights and everything else. Anyway, you have to come up with a $30,000 PR campaign. And so it's distribution is very hard, and you're stuck with Amazon and a couple others. So it's the same thing. I did wonder, one thing I would say is your guides for filmmakers are actually called the Angry Filmmaker Survival Guide. And you have one about sound and you have one about, I guess, just the regular film industry. What advice would you give to someone, besides telling them they need to read these books and they're so readable, it's a joy to read them. What would you tell people who wanted to get into filmmaking right now?
You know, I would probably say the same thing my parents said, don't do it. I encourage people to do it, but know that it's hard work. It's long hours. You know, if you think that it's, you know, this fancy thing, you're going to meet all these people and all that other stuff, you know, forget about it. I mean, it takes a long time to become a decent filmmaker, let alone good. You know, it takes years to really get the craft down and to be good at what you do. Don't think that this is something that you can do instantly because you've watched DVDs and you've seen the little behind the scenes afterwards, so you know what it's all about. You don't. It's like I say, it is very difficult. It's rewarding, as far as I'm concerned, once again, taking into consideration, you know, no job security, no vacations, no, you know, but what we do, you know, is terrific. I mean, 40 plus years down the road, I can't see myself doing anything different. But you have to be ready for the long haul. And I always tell people, if you want to get into this business, do not have a plan B. Because if you have a plan B, you're going to take it. You're going to jump off the moment you can. If you're really committed, you know, go big or go home.
It seems like you also have to be a very skilled hustler. And that comes natural for some people, but other people not so much.
That's the funny part about being an independent author too, because most writers that I think you and I both know really, really hate promoting their work. That's, you know, they would rather be off someplace running. But if you want to be an independent, you have to promote and you have to do this stuff. And it's the same thing with you. You have to hustle. You have to, you know, make those phone calls, especially if you're looking for money to make a film. I mean, all this stuff, you just have to do it. And that's part of the hard work.
Yes, you're both authors and you both know about the book industry. And so, yes, you speak with confidence and experience, I would say. Susan's written many books. In fact, I think, how do you guys know each other?
Kelly was teaching a screenwriting class, and I was fortunate enough to take it and met him, and he's a fabulous teacher. And I should note that he's also right now teaching at Pacific University, aren't you?
I'm teaching a history of film class, and that ends, I think, next week. I teach out there for friends, you know, they just bring me in every now and again. But I want to say too that, yes, Susan took my class and we immediately became fans of each other's work because I love her books. I haven't read the new one yet, but I love her work.
You won't be disappointed. It's a great book. Tell us the name, Susan. What's the name of your most recent ninth novel?
So it's the Sage Adair historical mystery series that takes place in the Pacific Northwest, mostly in Oregon. And the last one is called Unseen, and it is about the experience. It's they're all based on historical facts. And this one is about Native Americans' experience in Oregon in the early 1900s. And I have to say it was an excruciatingly painful experience researching for it, because, you know, I knew, like most people, you know, bits and pieces about the abuse that Indians have experienced. But boy, when you put the whole package together, you realize that the goal was extermination of them and their culture, mostly because of land grabs. And that sounds very negative, but I have to say that it's a very, I think, a very positive story, because it focuses on the strength of people who fought to change that situation.
Okay. So now you know you'll have to rush right out and get a copy of that book.
I think everybody needs to rush right out and get a copy of that book.
Yes, that would be good. And Susan's been a co-host with me numerous times on my fifth Mondays. And right now, we're just about ready to close up our show for the evening. We've been talking with Kelly Baker, who's a filmmaker, an angry filmmaker, and Susan Stoner, who is also an author and co-host of this production this evening. So I thank you both. And I hope that I meet up with you again in the future, both of you, of course. And it's been a pleasure. Any last words? Like, let's have your websites one more time. Kelly, what's your website?
Okay, my website is angryfilmmaker.com. And you'll find links to all of my books, my movies, T-shirts, and coffee mugs. What else could a person want or need for the holidays?
Yes.
Say that dogs feature heavily in Kelly's life experience, so for you dog lovers, it's a special treat, especially road dog.
And there's what, how many dogs are behind the scenes on this production today? Kelly, you have one dog?
I have 100 pounder laying next to me.
Okay, very quiet. And Susan, your dogs are hidden away somewhere?
Yes, I have two, and they're locked up in the bedroom, so their barks don't provide the background music.
Okay, well, we've got to give them a break, so let's sign off, and I hope our listening audience tunes in every Monday at 6 o'clock for KBOO Labor Radio Show. Thank you, and good evening.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. Meow, meow. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM Community Radio.
Are you still looking for a way to fit KBOO into your year-end giving? KBOO is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. For the last 14 years, Give Guide has raised over $28 million for hundreds of local nonprofits. Support KBOO and learn more about Give Guide by going to kboo.fm/give. Remember, we have a one-to-one match for all new and increasing donations, too. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
I'm Selena Flores.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. We're your hosts for this episode of It Did Happen Here. Episode 3 is the story of the Coalition for Human Dignity, or CHD.
The CHD did have a lot of contact with a lot of different groups. I was a staff person of the CHD. I was also a member of ACT UP in Portland. I had a very strong relationship with leadership at the Lesbian Community Project and in a variety of other places in the city. My connections became the organization's connections, and the organizational leadership at the board level also brought many relationships to the organization.
Check out the It Did Happen Here podcast at itdidhappenherepodcast.com. You can also go to kboo.fm and search It Did Happen Here.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO in Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We're here with folks with Oregonians Against Slavery and Involuntary Servitude. How y'all doing?
Great.
Doing well. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Great. Thanks so much for being on. Very interested in hearing about the project and what it entails, but would love to hear from y'all first, just introductions and or how you got involved.
I can go ahead and get started. This is Yakira. I'm the Director of Communications. And actually, the three of us on the call today all went to college together. And my personal involvement in criminal justice reform started with an introduction